This is starting, as usual, a little bit late, about 7 minutes late, because I forgot to turn on the recorder. All right. But I'm only going over stuff we did last time anyway. So all of this suggests that maybe this really is a case. Oh, and then the final feature of the sinking ship problem is that the transaction costs could be very high because you're bargaining under the pressure of the rising water, and the way the captain shows that he's not willing to pay $10 million or close to it is by taking a risk of the ship going down, which is a problem. One possible solution. One solution is pre-contracting, which, as we were told last time, happens in some parts of that market. Another solution is that the tug is expected to tow in the ship and then goes to an admiralty court, which decides what a fair price is. In a fully Coasean world, we could opt, meaning a zero transaction cost world, we could create sufficiently sophisticated contracts so that the tug, in effect, was agreeing to go out just as often as he would go out if he got the full $10 million, and the ship owner was agreeing to go out in storms just as often as he would go out if he only was charged $100,000, and then they could bargain over how much they actually got charged. I then point out that we go back to my water in the desert case, and lo and behold, we now understand why that's an odd and interesting case, because that's the same problem of two different actors and two different prices to give the right incentive. That to give my rescuer the right incentive to spend his time sitting out in the desert with a big tank of water, we want to reward him by the full benefit that he produces by doing that, and that means the whole value of my life to me if I, by any unlikely chance, end up needing that water. But if any time I wander out into the desert and end up needing water, I've got to pay, in effect, my lifetime income for the water, then I'm going to be much more careful about staying out of the desert than I ought to be, given that I'm not really imposing that cost on him. So the logic of the case is just the same as the tugboat case, even though they look very different. I don't think I make that point in the book. I think I worked that out after that book was written. All right, contracts of adhesion is a fancy name for form contracts, and I think the opposition to it really comes from a sort of a mental model that a lot of lawyers and other people have, that the way people deal with each other is bargaining. And economists recognize that bargaining exists, but their sort of base model is really impersonal markets, which is a different kind of situation. And the argument then is, well, I didn't get any word at all on how Dollar Rent-A-Car wrote the contract that I signed yesterday. No, day before yesterday, now. When I rented a car from them, therefore there's no reason to expect the contract to be fair to me. We need a sort of tug of war to get everybody's interests reflected. And my reply is, as long as I get to decide whether or not I rent from Dollar Rent-A-Car or from someone else or don't rent at all and take a bus, Dollar Rent-A-Car has an incentive to try to take my interest into account in designing the contract, so it'll be a contract I want to sign, and preferably I'm willing to sign at a high price. That's right, yeah. Except that putting it that way is really not a very good analogy, because the process is very unlike voting. That if I vote for one thing in a democratic system, that doesn't reduce my ability to vote on the next issue. But if I spend a dollar on one thing, that dollar isn't available to be spent on another. So one of the attractions of the market as opposed to the democratic solution is people are better able to concentrate their resources on the things important to them, and those will be different things for different people, so you come closer to giving everybody what he wants. Now, to some extent, of course, you've got the same effect in fancier democratic contexts where you've got log rolling and, you know, vote trading and so forth, which gives you something a little bit like a market in a democracy. Anyway, and so I then suggest that really the best form of government is competitive dictatorship, that's how we run hotels and restaurants. Why do you use form contracts? And I argue one obvious reason is to save costs, but another less obvious reason is to control your employees. If you accept freedom of contract, then interpretation is the same issue as design. You find out what terms maximize the sum gain, write them if you're a party, and add them if you're filling in blanks. And risk allocation we've gone over, and we can see how the economics of insurance tells us what are the factors we want to consider in deciding which party to a contract bears various risks. Questions so far? This is really a review of what we did before. My Himalayan photographer story, where the photographer drops off his $100 million film with Walmart and they lose it. Should they be liable? But of course, we're again back with Coase. This is the sort of thing that makes one appreciate how much one gets from very simple ideas, if they're important simple ideas that you haven't thought about before, because Coase tells us the loss of that expensive film was the joint product of actions by two parties, and how likely it is to happen depends on the precautions taken by those two parties. And one of the parties was Walmart, and one of them was the photographer. Of course, Walmart decided how to handle the film, but the photographer decided to simply drop it off with Walmart instead of going to some processor who he would tell this is really important film, be really careful with it, and he would charge him a higher price accordingly. And then the economics of this, what says, look, again, where do you have a more elastic supply or demand? Walmart is not going to make their procedures much more careful because one film in 20 million is worth a fortune. On the average, that's still only, you know, something on the order of a penny or so a film. On the other hand, if the photographer can't collect damages from Walmart, he then has an incentive, which he'll surely act on, to be more careful what he does with this very fancy film. Right. So that's the bottom line of that particular argument. And one reason I want you to remember it is that we are later going to come across a different legal issue in a different part of the law where I'm going to claim that the logic of the issue is essentially the same. And it's interesting because Posner both justifies the way the law this handles this case, which is the way essentially I describe it, and the way the law handles the other case, which is the opposite way. In each case, he comes up with a law and econ argument in favor of it, but it doesn't occur to him to apply the second argument to the first case or the first argument to the second case. So that's a nice illustration. Not so much there's nothing wrong with Posner, but that a risk of going out and looking at the data trying to test your theory is that if you look at the data before you finish writing the theory, you can very often manage to make the theory predict whatever you find out is true by which, in this case, by which of the law and econ potential arguments you look at and emphasize. But we'll get back to that later, but I think it's sort of interesting. We'll see. Other reasons not to enforce contracts. Third-party effects are the obvious one, that the parties are maximizing their gains, not the world's gains, and the possibility that some parties cannot be trusted to make decisions in their own. All right, we now get to breach, which is, I think, close to where we were ended last time. And what we really want is to find ways of preventing opportunistic breach but permitting efficient breach. So opportunistic breach is the case where at some point in the period during which the contract is getting performed by the parties, one of the parties says to himself, if I walked out right now, I would be better off than if the contract was completed. And the reason is not because the net gains from the contract will be higher, there will be cases like that as well, but only because at this instant, I got the gains, he's got the losses, basically. And you might try to prevent opportunistic breach either when you draw up the contract by trying to keep that situation from ever arising. You might do it via reputational mechanisms because people don't want to have the reputation that they, in effect, cheat on their partners, in this case, contract partners. Will in fact be getting later on in the next week to the case of cheating in their partners in the conventional sense, that is, that adultery is one example of opportunistic breach, as is divorcing your wife at the point when your value in the marriage market is still high and hers has declined and you think you can get a better deal, which is an issue we'll be discussing. How do you prevent that? And you can do it by having penalties in which the court says you broke the contract, you owe some damages. But at the same time, we want to permit efficient breach when circumstances change such that the parties are on net better off. And there are at least two mechanisms you can do that, by which you can do that. One is by special casing it, and this is something we'll see again in other contexts like criminal law or tort law. You can say, look, you're not allowed to breach a contract, But in this case, you can go to the court and say, look, here is the good reason. It became impossible to perform the contract because the construction site where we had agreed to finish a certain stage of the construction by a month from now happens to be in the middle of New Orleans, and at the moment it's under 14 feet of water. Therefore, on grounds of impossibility, we're not required to fulfill our contract. That would be one example. But in general, if you think about sort of the logic of what we're doing almost all through the course, we are either getting people to do the right thing by giving them an incentive where they decide what the right thing is, for example, a Pigouvian tax kind of thing, where we just arrange, they bear the cost, they then decide, or we're having the court say, we will decide what the right thing is. If you do the wrong thing, we'll punish you. If you do the right thing, we won't. And even, I mean, there's a certain sense in which an effluent fee isn't really a punishment, or at least it's a different thing than saying you shouldn't have done this, so we'll punish you to stop it. It's rather maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't. We'll impose the cost on you, so you'll decide. So in the case of breach, you could either have the court special case it, or for that matter, the contract could special case it, could say under these circumstances you don't have to perform. Or we can do the equivalent of a Pigouvian tax, which is expectation damages. We can say if I breach the contract, I've got to make up to you your loss from it. That means it'll only pay me to breach the contract if the gain to me from breach is greater than the loss to you. Very simple. However, it turns out that the world is always just more complicated than that, because when we set up our rules for what happens when breach occurs, we also affect people's incentive on two other margins. One of the margins is, do I breach or not? One of the choices I have to make. A second one is, should I sign the contract in the first place? We'll get back to that later. But there are some circumstances in which the damage rule that gives you the right incentive to breach or not breach the contract may give a party the wrong incentive to sign or not sign the contract. And finally, there's the issue referred to as reliance, which is that if you might breach, should I, in deciding how I'm going to perform, take into account the risk of your breach? So that if I say I could do my part of the contract in either of two ways, one of them is the better way to do it if I'm sure either the contract's going to go through, but is going to lose a bunch of money if it turns out that for some reason the contract breaks down. Should I allow for the risk of the contract breaking down and deciding whether to do that or not? All right. So that's the reliance problem. So let's go back to contract design first. Opportunistic breach happens because at some point one of the sides is better off breaching. And we can think of my sort of standard, very simple example. I hire you to build a house on my property. If I pay you at the beginning, you take the money and run. If I pay you at the end I say to you, well, you know, I realize this house is yours, but the land is mine. If you really want to disassemble the house and try to sell the pieces, feel free. If not, let's renegotiate how much I'm paying you for the house. So how do we avoid that problem? One way we avoid the problem is that as you build the house, I make a set of progress payments. And if we've designed it right, there is no point at which I profit by saying, oops, I've decided I'm not going to pay you anymore, at which point you stop building the house. And there's no point at which you say to me, oops, I'm going to stop building the house because then I won't pay you anymore. Very simple example, but I think it carries with it an important element of how you design contracts. The one problem with that, though, is that we can't perfectly predict in advance what the pattern of cost is going to be. So you could imagine, I'm using cost really very generally. It doesn't have to be building a house. It could be anything where the gains and costs to us are varying over time of breaching. And if something happens such that suddenly your gain to breach becomes higher than it was before and higher than we expected it to be, then our precaution may break down. All right, you get an offer for another job, and it's true that even with that offer, on net, the two of us are better off completing the contract, but you are better off breaching because the arrangement we made that was supposed to prevent opportunistic breach didn't give you enough of the gain at that particular point to outweigh this opportunity. All right? And one solution, which I'll get back to when we get back to discussing my article, is hostages. See, one solution is changing the terms of payment. If we say, I make a big deposit on the house, that reduces the chance that it'll pay me to breach the contract. The trouble is it increases the chance it'll pay you to breach the contract, because now if you breach, you walk away with my deposit. Remember, we're talking about contract design. We're not assuming anybody can sue anyone. I'm just looking at how do you keep it from ever getting to the court. Or how do you do it in a world where the court isn't there, which is what my article is partly about. And one neat way around it is hostages. If I have some way in which I can hand you something which it'll hurt me a whole lot if you keep but won't be worth anything to you, then we can understand that if I breach the contract, you will confiscate the hostage. That's a reason not for me not to breach, but it's not a reason for you to breach. And the story I usually tell at this point in the discussion, and I'll tell it again because it's a good story, even though it's not absolutely vital, a historical incident. Do any of you know about the Stephen and Matilda troubles in England in the, I guess it's got to be the early 12th century? No. As you probably remember, William, Duke of Normandy, conquers England in 1066, one of these famous dates we all memorize. It turns out that I think about two generations later, his, I think, grandson dies without a male heir. And the grandson has a daughter, and I'm not sure if the daughter has a child by then or not. And he also has, I think, a nephew, if I remember. And the daughter's name is Matilda, and she's referred to as the Empress Matilda because she had at some point been the wife of the Holy Roman Emperor. And I'm not, I guess he died or divorced her or something. Anyway, she wasn't at the point when the story was happening. And Stephen is, I think, the Count of Blois. He's an important nobleman. And the king is dying, and the king gets everybody in sight to swear to support Matilda, not literally as his heir, because everybody agrees that a woman can't be ruler of England, but on behalf of her son, who either isn't born yet or is an infant at this point. And it turns out that there is a real legal ambiguity having to do, I think, with differences between English and Norman law on whether or not a throne can be inherited through a woman. That at this stage, everybody agrees that a throne can't be inherited by a woman, but the question is, if I have a daughter and she has a son, can that son claim as the heir over other claimants, such as my nephew? Some people say yes, some people no. And it turns out that at the point when Henry I, I think who was the king in question, dies, Matilda is not on the scene and Stephen is. Stephen's brother is the Archbishop of Canterbury and promptly crowns Stephen King of England. And the result is 14 years of back and forth civil war with some barons supporting one and some the other, finally settled by a negotiated agreement in which it's agreed that Stephen will be king for the rest of his life, which is about to be only a year or so, but will be succeeded by Matilda's son, who becomes Henry II, famous English king. Anyway, at one point in this mess, and it was apparently a real mess, there is a baron of no great importance by the name of Gilbert Marshall, who, by the standards of that civil war, was an honorable man because he only switched sides once. He had initially supported Stephen. Early on, Matilda offered him a better deal, and for the rest of the Civil War, he supports Matilda. And he's holding a castle, and Stephen shows up in front of the castle with an army and says, please surrender your castle to me, because I'm going to take the castle whether you like it or not. And Gilbert says to Stephen, well, yes, I agree, you could take the castle, but it'll cost you lives and, you know, time and stuff like that. I got a deal I want to offer you. And the deal I will offer you is that you give me 3 days. And I am going to send a message to Matilda asking her to send an army to relieve the siege of the castle, which I'm after all holding for her. And the deal is if she doesn't, or her side doesn't show up with an army in 3 days, I'll surrender the castle to you so you don't have to siege it or storm it or any of that messy stuff. And Stephen says, sounds like a good deal to me, but how do I know you won't cheat? And Gilbert says, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you one of my sons. And so he turns over young William Marshall to be a hostage. And Stephen, who has other things to do with his army, goes off somewhere. And Gilbert promptly starts hiring soldiers, bringing in supplies, and making ready for a siege. Because both Gilbert and Stephen know that Matilda has no army close enough to do any good, which is why Stephen accepts the deal, but why Gilbert is only making the deal because he's planning to cheat on him. 3 days later, Stephen comes back with his army and says, all right, no relieving force, please surrender. And Gilbert says, ha ha, I fooled you. And Stephen says, then I'll hang the kid. And Gilbert says, have I not three more sons? And still the hammer and the anvil to forge more? And in fact, Stephen does not kill the kid. And there are various stories, I'll get to the end of how I know about all of this, about he's going to throw the kid from a siege engine into the castle, and the kid, who is a very cute kid, sees the siege engine and says, hey, playground equipment, can I climb on it? But anyway, there's a sequence of things, and eventually Stephen is not hard-hearted enough to carry it through. Whether Gilbert suspected that, we don't know. And the reason all this story survives is that William Marshall grows up to become the most famous tournament knight in Western Europe, somebody who probably regarded Richard Lionheart, the Lionhearted, as a talented amateur, and before he dies is regent of England for John, after Richard and John have both died. So he becomes a very important figure, and is a nice example, actually, of social mobility in a feudal system, because Gilbert is a very minor figure, William is his fourth son, inherits nothing of any importance, but he ends up being an important figure for several reigns, being in effect the Earl of an important Pembroke, and in effect the king of about a quarter of Ireland, both of them through a marriage, which is really his reward for his services to King Henry II. But anyway, but it's a nice hostage story, even if it's only tangential. I like stories. Easy to remember. And they're fun. But in any case, so that's the hostage idea. Now, I want to claim that a lot of contractual enforcement is, in fact, reputation. That, in fact, my guess is that most of the reason that people keep their promises in the business world is not the fear of being sued, though that happens. It's the fear of being thought not to be reliable and therefore not to be a good person to deal with in the future. And it basically, what makes it work is either repeat dealings with one customer or the prospect of dealing with other customers who will believe what they're told about your cheating the first customer. And if you think about reputational enforcement, it's an interesting subject because it's one of these cases where you get a good result by accident. That the reason I don't deal with you after you cheated him is not that I want to punish you. It's not that I want to give you an incentive not to cheat. It's that I don't want to get cheated. All right, so it's a side effect. It's not a direct function. In order for this mechanism to work, we have two conditions. One of them is that taking the money and run isn't worth doing. That you can't say, I'm going to make a big enough killing on this one cheating so that I don't mind burning my reputation. And it's I've seen it argued that one of the reasons why in the 19th century when people started banks, they had fancy buildings, marble facings and such, was that by building that building, which isn't good for much other than a bank, you are demonstrating to your customers that you've sunk enough money into creating a bank in this town that you're not going to just take their deposits and skip town, and therefore they're willing to do business with you. So you can see that as an example of deliberately spending money in order to bond yourself in a certain odd sense. But there's a second requirement, and that is that interested third parties can find out who cheated at a low cost. Because after all, if you and I have a contract and I break the contract, and you tell him I cheated, I say, no, no, the guy's lying. The truth is he cheated. He didn't deliver the stuff he had said he'd deliver on time. And so, of course, I backed out of the contract. All right, that's the natural way for anybody to behave. If he can't easily tell which one of us is lying, what is he going to do? How will it affect his future behavior if he says, I know one of them cheated, but I don't know which one? If you know that that's the result of your reporting that I cheated, what are you going to do?
Not report.
Not report. So the result is that in order for the reputational enforcement to work, except for repeat dealings with the same customer, there needs to be some way in which the interested third party at not too high a cost can find out which of the two of us is cheating, who's lying. Otherwise, his simplest solution is just to avoid both of us. And if he does that, then the information never comes out. So how do we create these conditions? And one of them, the first one, to avoid people being able to take money and run, is some version of posting a bond. Marble-faced buildings function as a bond, putting up a bond with a trusted third party, whatever you like. But in some way, doing something such that cheating is going to be expensive for me. How do we handle the second one? My claim is that an important role of commercial arbitration is to lower information costs to third parties, because typically commercial arbitration is happening within an industry. The people in the industry all know about the arbitration mechanism. And even if the arbitration isn't enforceable, and that's going to depend on the particular time, place, country, context, and so forth, but even if there's no court enforcement, as long as everybody in the industry knows that you claimed I broke the contract, we both went to arbitration, and the arbitrator we agreed with said, yes, indeed, he broke the contract, now they know they can trust you and can't trust me. All right? So you can think of arbitration, I think, interestingly, as a way in which you lower information costs to third parties. All right, let's go on to the legal solution to the problem. We said first, contract design, second, reputation, third, damages. And there, the obvious economic rule is what are called expectation damages, which mean that you're supposed to make the other party as well off as if you hadn't breached. And that's Pigou's rule, basically, because that says, I've got to make up to you your loss for my breach, so I'll only breach if my gain is bigger than your loss, in which case I ought to breach. But one problem with that is that expectation damages give you the wrong incentives with regard to reliance. And this is I'm running through the example on the screen. I can produce my widgets in the factory I've now got at $2.10 a widget, or I can spend $1 million retooling and then in my retooled factory produce them for $1 a widget. So the first way is going to cost me $2,100,000. The second way is going to cost me $2 million. All right? See? Because the first way is $2,100,000, $1 million widgets at $2.10 a piece, and the second way, it's $1 million for the widget plus $1 million for the retooling. That's $2 million. I'm assuming the retooling is not useful for anything else. On the other hand, if after I retool you decide to cancel your order, I've just lost $1 million. I just wasted $1 million. So if I'm sure you're going to keep the contract, clearly I want to retool. What if I'm not sure you'll keep the contract, but the legal rule is expectation damages, so if you breach the contract, you are going to have to make me as well off as you didn't. Do I retool or not? Expectation damages, either you perform the contract, or you break it, and you've got to compensate me by the full value to me of what I would have gotten if you had performed it. Why not?
Because if you break the contract, you don't have to pay. If you think the other person's going to break the contract, then you don't have to pay for the price of retooling, so you essentially get to keep the money.
No, you're going to retool because if I'm making 10 extra cents per widget, and even if you cancel the contract, I've already retooled and that. Some cost that will help you in the future.
We don't have to help you in the future. The point is that your retooling is going to be paid for by the other guy.
Right.
If we've got expectation damages, if he breaches, he's going to have to pay me that $1 million. It's going to make me as well off as if he performed. So he's got to give me the same results as if it had all gone through. So if he's not going to breach, I should retool. If he's going to breach, I should retool. He's going to be very unhappy at paying $1 million for nothing, but that's going to be what the court's going to award. So the result is that expectation damages give you too much incentive to rely, because in the case where there's a significant chance of breach, you, the potential victim of the breach, it's not true for the guy who's going to breach, but the one who's a potential victim is going to make his actions as if there was no chance of breach. Now you might think, if you happen to remember, that another damage rule is reliance damages, that they solve that problem, but unfortunately they don't. That reliance damages have exactly the same problem. All the difference is that reliance damages is supposed to make you as well off as if you hadn't signed the contract in the first place. And the difference, therefore, is whatever profit you expected from the contract, your lost profits. But with reliance damages, with expectation damages, I retool, because I say if he doesn't breach it, I'm going to make an extra 10 cents per widget by retooling. And if he does breach it, I'll make an extra 10 cents per widget by retooling, because he has to make me as well off as if he hadn't breached. With reliance, I say, if he doesn't breach it, I make an extra 10 cents per widget for retooling. If he does breach it, I don't get any benefit from retooling, but it doesn't cost me anything because he's going to have to pay my at least $1 million for my tooling costs, because he's got to make me as well off as if I hadn't signed. So my incentive to retool is a little bit weaker with reliance, but it's still greater than zero, and that's enough to make me retool. If you think through the logic of it, it dilutes the benefit of my reliance, but it never changes the benefit of reliance into a cost. So that actually is not a solution, as you might think. Let's consider, however, one more possible problem, which I've already got two. One of them is the incentive to breach. One is the incentive to rely. And the last one is the incentive to sign the contract in the first place. So suppose we happen to have a case where there is some possible future event which will cause you to breach the contract. And suppose you have very little information on the likelihood of that event, but I know quite a lot about it. And you can, a little imagination, you can think up some scenario where the risk is in an area I know about, but the breach, if it happens, will be by you. Right, so in that case, if you're liable either way, I am happy to sign the contract whatever the chance of breach is, because you're going to compensate me if you breach. Your willingness to sign the contract depends on the chance of breach, but you don't know what it is. So we now have what's essentially an adverse selection kind of problem, where the contract may not get signed because you say, you tell me that the thing isn't going to happen, but I don't believe you, because you tell me even if it were going to. All right? It's essentially the same problem we've faced before with adverse selection. So in that particular case, the solution would be, for that problem, that I, who knows about it, should bear the cost of your breach. Because if I'm going to bear the cost of you... Now, that doesn't give you the right incentive to breach. I'm only solving one problem. I may be messing up a different one. But in the situation I've described, if I'm the one who pays the cost of the bad thing happening, I know how likely it is and can decide what price I'm willing to pay given that probability. You no longer care because you're going to be compensated if it happens, so you don't have to know the probability. So that's just like my insuring the used car I'm selling you. It's the same logic of it, basically. Clear? Not clear? Oh. All right. Let's finally consider one more damage rule, which in fact in the real world is quite an important one, and that's liquidated damages. That liquidated damages, as you probably all know, means that we agree in advance on what the damages for breach will be. And that's the perfect rule, provided we know what they're going to be in advance. So if we can say in advance the amount that it will be if you breach, that the cost you will impose on me if you breach will be $1 million. If we know that, then we say if you breach, you pay $1 million. Now, not only do you have the right incentive to breach, I have the right incentive to rely. Because I'm going to get the same $1 million from you for breach whether or not I retooled my factory, and therefore the decision of retooling the factory is only relevant in the case where you don't breach, and then I can say, does that make my money or lose me money? But I say, look, if I don't, even if the million somehow included some possibility of my retooling the factory, I'm going to get it whether I retool or not, so it doesn't compensate me for the loss of retooling a factory that doesn't produce anything. Is that clear or not? So reliance, so liquidated is a nice solution if only you have the information to estimate in advance. And the problem is you often don't. Any more questions on that bit? I'm going through fairly quickly, but everybody seems to at least act as if he's got it. Yeah? No.
On the liquidated.
Yes.
So it will only cover the widgets that I will produce.
It will cover whatever we think ex ante is the cost that my breach imposes.
Right.
So if we're pretty sure that you're in fact going to rely, it's clear that given the probabilities it pays you to rely. In that case, part of the liquidated damages is going to be my compensating you for that $1 million retooling.
Okay.
All right? But it doesn't depend on whether you do rely. It only depends on whether you should have, so to speak. And so it doesn't affect your incentive to then rely. All right, let me go one thing which I haven't discussed here, though I think I discussed it in the book, is the courts are sometimes unwilling to enforce, maybe I don't discuss it in the book, I don't remember, anyway, to enforce liquidated damage clauses if they think they're penalty clauses. All right, a penalty clause is a liquidated damage clause which the court thinks is a good deal more than the real damage. And I want to claim that the courts are being inconsistent in this. Because suppose it really is a penalty clause. In terms of our previous ideas, what is the effect of a penalty clause in a contract when breach becomes possible? Suppose the deal is that if I breach the contract, I have to pay you $1 million, even though my breaching is only going to make you $200,000 worse off. And a situation arises where performing the contract will have net costs for us. Performing the contract will cost you $200,000 and it will make me $400,000, so therefore on net we're better off if I breach. But if I breach, you can claim $1 million. What's going to happen?
Should I?
What should you do? Is having my perform the contract the best outcome for you?
You should encourage the breach.
In exchange for a payment of more than $200,000 and less than $300,000. You see? The logic, it's back to Coase's solutions again. That the logic of the situation is that breaching produces a net benefit for us. So therefore, rather than forcing me to perform, a better deal is to get me to pay you to buy permission to breach. Because I'm willing to buy permission for breach for a higher price than the actual cost to you of my breaching. So if my breaching costs you $200,000, but I'm liable for $1 million, you say if I only ask him $300,000, since it's going to save him $400,000 by breaching, if I demand a $300,000 payment for permission to breach, he'll pay the $300,000. I'm better off getting $300,000 and losing $200,000 than I would be having him perform, because at the $1 million he's going to perform. All right? So what have we just done? We have just converted a liability rule into a property rule. All right? Going back to stuff we were doing a month or two ago, a liability rule says the way I decide whether or not to use your property is that if I use it, I owe you damages for the cost I imposed. A property rule says the way I decide whether to use your property is that I have to make you an offer that you're willing to accept to let me use it. The legal system in general takes it for granted that some things are controlled by property rules and some by liability rules. And my claim is that all a penalty clause is a privately negotiated property rule. What a penalty clause is an agreement between the two parties. In effect, I can only breach with your permission. I have given you the ownership of whether or not I perform this contract with some extreme limits with $1 million. And just as a property rule is sometimes a sensible rule in general, it is sometimes a sensible contractual rule. You can easily enough imagine cases where we say, look, we think it's going to be very hard for a court to estimate damages. On the other hand, I've got a good reputation. I want people to think I'm a decent, reasonable guy. So I'm not going to try to hold you up for a fortune if you have to breach. We can handle it better by negotiating on the market than we can by going to court. And if that's what we feel, one way of doing that is a penalty clause. So the claim I at least want to make is that the courts refusing to enforce a penalty clause are saying to contracting partners, you would never find it in your interest to do something that we quite routinely require people to do. Namely, have a property rule. Any questions on that? No. Anyway, I don't remember if that's in the book or not. I'd have to look. I may have worked it out afterwards. All right, let's go on to something that is in the book, but which is interesting because Posner gets part of it wrong, I think. And that's the case of one-sided contracts. And the example is I offer a reward for the return of my lost cat. You find the cat and return it. You have not seen the reward sign, so you don't demand the reward. The next day you see the sign, you come back and ask for the money. And my reply is, sorry, buddy. If you'd asked when you had the cat, I'd have paid it. But there was no contract, because we all know a contract requires a meeting of the minds, and there could be no meeting of the minds if you didn't know I had the offer out. And it is then I gather, somewhat debatable legal issue whether or not I'm legally obliged to pay in that situation, whether we can have, in that sense, a one-sided contract. All right? And I think Posner asks what I think is the right question from an economist standpoint, which is not, is there a meeting of minds, not is this a contract, but are the results of treating it as a contract good or bad? All right? And the answer to that is complicated, even more complicated than he realizes. Because one effect of holding it binding is that when I happen to see a cat that looks like a lost cat, and I'm saying, should I try to lure this cat into my possession at some risk of getting scratched, and try to pet it and make it like me, and then carry it off to somewhere where I can ask around whether anybody's lost a cat, in deciding whether to spend an hour and a half doing that, I say to myself, well, I don't know that there's a reward out for this cat, but people do post rewards for lost animals, so it's a gamble, and with luck, I might get some money out of it. Whereas if the legal rule is if you don't know about it, you can't collect it, then I say, well, goodbye, kitty cat. Nice seeing you, but why should I spend my time collecting? So you would expect that the legal rule making it binding increases the incentive for lost cats. However, and I don't remember if Posner makes this point or not, he should, he certainly could, if I know that offering a reward means that I'll have to pay the reward both to people who saw it and to those who didn't, that means that on average the cost to me of offering a reward is higher, because I'm more likely to have to pay it out. I don't get to get away scot-free if somebody brings in the cat who didn't see the sign. But the higher the cost to me of offering a reward, the less willing I'll be to offer a reward. So I'll offer lower rewards or won't offer a reward. And that will result in fewer cats being found. Because people looking around their experience of the world say, yeah, people occasionally offer rewards for lost cats, but not very much. They're pretty skinflint types, and when they do, it's only $20. So if you think, if the question you ask is the question that Posner asks, which is, are cats more likely to be brought in if we do or don't enforce the contract? The real answer is, so far at least, we don't know. Because one effect will make them more likely and one less likely. I want to claim, however, that he's asking the wrong question. The question he asks, when I say he, I'm referring to Posner's textbook, Economic Analysis of Law, which is where I lifted this particular question from. And what he says is, the question we have to ask is, are cats more likely to be brought in? And I want to see if either of you can tell me why that's not the question we want to ask. I'm willing to limit it to cats.
The question would be whether the reward, a cat that has a reward for it, is more likely to be brought in, not cats in general.
No, because one of the ways it's going to affect it is that it'll affect the chance of cats having rewards. A lost cat, whether lost cats are more likely to be brought in. Well, look, suppose we wanted to make the probability really high that lost cats were brought in. Can you think of some ways of doing it? Much higher than any of this. Suppose the rule that everybody has to register as pets. And if you lose a lost cat, we fine you $100,000. And now, when you lose a cat, you spend the next week searching for him, and you post a $1,000 reward. Is that a better or worse world?
I mean, I would say worse.
Because? It resulted in more cats being brought in. Why is it still a worse world? From an economist's standpoint, right?
Because
$100,000 is being randomly given to people. Don't worry about whether the government wastes the money. That's a legitimate problem, but it's not the one I want to focus on. I want to think $100,000 is an incentive. Why is that world wrong? If you don't like the $100,000, say, if you lose a cat and don't search very hard for it, we'll shoot you. And imagine that everybody, that we never have to shoot anybody because everybody
has it. $100,000 is way more than the value.
And therefore, people will search harder than it's worth.
Right.
That you want it, what you're maximizing in any of these cases is not the benefit, it's the benefit net of the costs.
Right.
So if we say there's a huge penalty for losing cats, then people will not only spend an amount of resources that's appropriate given the value to them of the cat, they will also spend much more than that. And so the question we want to ask, I'm not claiming I have an answer, the question we want to ask is not, are cats more likely to be found, but is the net gain from the enterprising of searching for cats greater, where that gain is net of the time and effort spent looking for cats? All right. That's the point I want to make, because it's a very, very common mistake, which economists should never make, but which everybody else always makes, to think in terms of maximizing some particular benefit rather than maximizing that benefit net of its cost. So if somebody says the right criterion for our healthcare system is life expectancy or is cure rate or something like that, he's wrong. That's what you're trying to produce, but you're producing at a cost. If you can push up life expectancy by a day at the cost of 10% of GNP extra going into medical services, that's a loss, because a day is not worth 10% of my life's income. All right? So that was the point I wanted to make, but it's a I think, a fairly important and fairly general point. All right, let me go on to another question, which is...
So wait, I have a question about that.
Sure.
Are we essentially saying that that mistake neglects the cost side then? That we're basically focusing, oh, look, there's a benefit here, but you forgot that adding a benefit to the cost actually makes the equation go negative on
it? It might. Adding, subtracting the cost for the benefit. That's right. I'm saying that certainly in the context of economic efficiency, but I also argue in the context of almost any rational behavior, what you really want to ask is the effect of this on net good? And that means not, do we get something valuable, or do we get something valuable at a cost that's less than that value? And that people are very, very routinely, if you think about somebody saying, look, we need a light rail system. And there's a very strong tendency for people to say, would I like the city to have a light rail system? And not to say, would I like the city to have a light rail system and me to have $1,000 less money, which is whatever the amount is. And I think that's and part of the reason, of course, is that you're focusing on the thing you're producing. You're not focusing on, you've got an elaborate tax system and who knows where it'll come from, and that's all sort of vague and fuzzy. All right. Anyway, so let me go on to a different issue, but one is related to contract, which is the issue of fraud. And this is the question of what I am obliged to tell you when I make a contract with you. And the example I discussed in the book, because it's a famous real case, is the War of 1812 example, where what happens is that during the War of 1812, the British are blockading U.S. commerce. New Orleans is a port from which a lot of tobacco is exported, and the tobacco is just piling up in storage in New Orleans because they can't get it to the markets because the British Navy is in the way. A small part of the British Navy is in the way. From the standpoint of what we think of as the War of 1812, of course, from the British standpoint, it was a minor distraction of the Napoleonic Wars, which they were more or less fighting for their life. But for a little while, they managed to get into war with us as well as France, due to the fact that as part of their war with France, they were doing things the U.S. disapproved of, such as impressing American sailors into the British Navy. All right. Not wholly unreasonable, because, of course, from their standpoint, American sailor is a claim, not a fact. This guy speaks English. For all we know, he's an English citizen who went off to America a year ago, and since we need sailors, we're going to interpret it that way, so to speak. But anyway, that ended up the War of 1812. War of 1812 is this famous case where the decisive battle of the war was fought after it was over, which makes decisive an odd term. But it was at least decisive because it resulted in Andrew Jackson becoming president of the U.S., because Andrew Jackson was commanding the American forces in the Battle of New Orleans. The treaty negotiations were happening in Europe, and they didn't have telegraphs and radios, so the result was that Britain and the U.S. had agreed on a peace treaty, I don't know, a week or two before the battle is fought, which the U.S. wins. And the legal story is that you've got somebody in the tobacco business, and he goes to someone else in the tobacco business, I'd like to buy some of that tobacco you got in the warehouse. And the guy says, all right, what are you offering? And they agree on a price, and they sign a contract for sale, but it hasn't been delivered. And the next day, the news gets in that the war is over. And it turns out, how it turned out, I don't know, that the guy who made the offer had the news early. That somehow he knew, before it was public information, that the war was over, and he was therefore buying tobacco whose current market value was, you know, $1,000, which he knew perfectly well was going to be worth $3,000 tomorrow. The question is, does the second guy get to back out of the contract? And that was a real law case, and the decision was that he did not get to back out. And it's interesting because the standard arguments for freedom of contract, you would seem to say, well, since he didn't have the information, there's no reason to assume the contract produced a net benefit. It was a way in which one guy profited mainly at the expense of someone else. Why should we want to encourage that? And one possible answer to that is that by making that legal rule, you give people an incentive to gather information. That if you imagine that we have things we would like to know, we want ways of making in people's interest not only to find them out, but in some way to convey the information to the rest of us. And speculation is an elegant way of doing that, because we say, here's a grain market, we've got grain futures, if I can predict a rise in prices of grain before anybody else can, I can buy up grain now, sell it at a high price. And what will I do? What will the effect of doing that? Buying it now will tend to drive the price up now. Selling it later will tend to drive the price down later. So the result of profitable speculation, speculation by someone whose information is right, is to smooth out price movements, which in the case of food means to reduce the risk of famine, because it means that at the point when the harvest fails, if enough people could predict the harvest failing, they at that point started filling up warehouses with grain. Those warehouses now sell at a high price, and the result is people don't starve to death. And the speculators make money, of course, which is the point of it. And I would argue, at least, that the belief that speculators are bad guys, which you see continually, we've seen it in this latest thing, may be one of the most lethal economic errors in history. Because in order for speculation to play the role I've described, speculators need secure property rights. And the danger is that if people say, what are speculators? They're people who make their money off other people's misfortune, off other people's hunger. Therefore, when the famine arrives, we're not going to buy the grain from the speculators. We're just going to break down the doors of their warehouses and get the people's grain out. If that's what you do, then the next famine kills people, because speculators won't, in fact, store up grain if they don't expect to be able to sell it afterwards. So it's a dangerous, dangerous fallacy. But at the same time that the idea that speculators are bad guys is wrong, it is nonetheless true that speculation is economically rather odd. And it's odd in exactly the same way that reputational enforcement is odd. Because you are producing a benefit, but your incentive for producing the benefit is not related to how big the benefit is. Imagine a case where, like the case we've just described, the tobacco case, where the relevant information I get only a day before everybody else. If I get it a month before everybody else, the result of my driving up grain prices is that people consume less food now when it's plentiful, that they don't feed grain to animals because they want to save it for humans, that they import grain, they do various things that improve the situation. But if I only find out a day in advance, the famine is just as bad, because a day in advance just means that prices go up a day earlier. But I make a whole lot of money, because when prices go up, I got the grain. So we have a case where I have a self-interested incentive to do a good thing, namely gather information in advance and make prices reflect the information, but the size of the incentive is independent of the size of the good thing, and therefore you might have people spending a lot of money gathering information when the information is worth very little. So it's not a standard sort of why economics is efficiency story at all, even though it's an interesting story. As I say at the bottom of this, what we want in this case as in all others is not incentives, but the right incentives. Speculation gives us an incentive to do the right, a good thing, but it might be too little or too large an incentive. We don't know that. But in any case, it's an argument for that court decision. Let me spend our last 15 minutes on a subject which, in fact, is relevant to contracts, and in particular to the paper of mine that I had you read, but is, I think, relevant to a bunch of other things, and is one of my candidates for ways in which the world you will live your lives in is going to be very different from the world I lived my life in so far. Does either of you know what public key encryption is? All right. So it's sort of like not knowing about the atomic bomb. It's just that's not going to become obvious for a while. I want to send a secret message to you. And sort of old technology, we arranged to be somewhere with nobody else around that I whisper to you. Doesn't work nowadays because we've got bugs and laser beams bouncing off windows and picking up vibrations from sounds and all sorts of other ways of spying on people. I send you a message, especially if you're not close to me, and I scramble the message. And the traditional way of doing it is there is some description of how to scramble and unscramble, which we call the key to the encryption. And I make sure you have the key, and then I send you a message that I've scrambled, and you unscramble it. Is that right? And the problem with that technology, one problem, is that if I don't have a safe way of getting you messages, I may not have a safe way of getting you keys either. And if whoever we're trying to keep secrets from got a copy of the key because my messenger was really working for him and not for me, now he can read all my future messages. Solution to this was something which mathematicians came up, I think, about 30 years ago. And it's a mathematical procedure that generates a pair of keys, two different long numbers. And the math is such that you can generate the two of them together by the same process. But given one, you can't deduce what the other one is. And it is also such that if you use one of the keys to scramble a message, you need the other one to unscramble it. So something scrambled with key A can only be unscrambled with the matching key B. Something scrambled with key B can only be unscrambled with the matching key A. I want people to be able to send me secret messages, so I say key A is my private key. It never leaves my hot little hands. I'll memorize it and burn the paper. Key B, I will publish to the world. I will put it on billboards. I will put it on my web page. I will hand it out on my business card. I'll make sure everybody's got it. You want to send me a secret message, you encrypt with key B, send it to me, and only I can read it. He who's the spy has key B, fine, he can send me secret messages too. But what he can't do is to read your secret messages. So it's a very powerful, I should say it's used, it's transparent to the user, but it's part of the encryption that's going on when you send in your Visa card and stuff along this line. Visa number. Anyway, so this is a technology which makes possible a level of privacy that we haven't had in the past, because we can arrange things so that anyone in the world can send me messages only I can read. It also turns out that the same technology solves the problem of proving identity at a distance. Because if I encrypt my message with key A, my private key, and tell you who it's from, you decrypt it with key B, my public key. The fact that what you get is a message and not gibberish tells you that I have the private key that matches that public key, but only I have the private key that matches my public key. So I've just proved the message is for me. And that's the guts of how digital signatures work. This has a very interesting feature, which is I can use it both to prove that I'm David D. Friedman, who's a professor at Santa Clara, provided I've got some way of getting his public key to you. But I can also use it to prove an online identity without releasing my real space identity. So my standard story for this is imagine that I were capable of giving valuable legal advice, which I'm probably not because I'm not competent in that, but suppose I were. But imagine, as is in fact the case, that I'm not a member of the bar. So I legally can't sell certain legal services. So I create a website, which is called Legal Eagle Online. And this website has got a public key on it, so that people will know that public key. And the website gives away legal advice, free legal advice. And we do it for about 6 months, and people who are interested in the subject notice, you know, that was really good legal advice, exactly the same legal advice I paid $500 to my lawyer for. And once I've established my reputation, I now start selling legal advice. And how can I prevent somebody else saying, I'm going to free ride on this reputation, pretend to be legal online and sell advice, because he doesn't have my private key. He therefore can't sign documents to prove he's legally eagle online. Everybody knows legal eagle's public key, so they can check the private key by seeing if they can decrypt when it encrypts. So that means that this technology makes it possible to combine anonymity and reputation. It's a very odd world if you think about it. And it has a bunch of features, some of them attractive and some unattractive. One of them is that it's a way of protecting people whose property is insecure. So suppose you are somebody living in a third world nation where you don't trust the legal authorities and you don't trust your neighbors. And if it were known that you were making $50,000 a year in Silicon Valley at long distance as a virtual programmer for Apple or something, or maybe much more than $50,000 if you're good at it, you would be at serious risk either of having the government deciding you should hand over half the money to them, or of having some enterprising neighbor kidnap your kids and ask for $50,000 to give them back. All right? So you don't want them to know that. And this technology allows you to have an online identity with nobody able to know what human being it is. I should say the technology also makes possible anonymous e-cash, which I haven't gone into, but which is another thing we don't have, but we could have. We know how to do it, which lets you get paid without people knowing who they're paying. So if you imagine the full-scale version of this, a world where everybody who matters has a public key that's out there, may, if he wish, have other public keys for his online identity. We all have high-speed internet connections, we all have access to anonymous free mailers, so I can talk to you without the FBI knowing I'm talking to you. So there's a bunch of stuff which I'm not going into. What I like to call a world of strong privacy. And it has attractive and unattractive features. First, it's a good way of evading taxes, because the government isn't seeing me earn the money. Second, it's a good way of evading regulations, which is good or bad, depending whether you like the regulations. But third, it's a way of guaranteeing freedom of speech that doesn't depend on what the courts think of it, because you can't arrest someone if you don't know who he is. That's a pretty good thing. But fourth, it's also a way of setting up criminal enterprises with brand name reputation, because I can sell the service of bootleg software, of assassinations, of buying and selling trade secrets, have a reliable firm that everybody knows really pays off when you give them your employer's trade secrets, but there is no way that my employer can know who betrayed them, and there's no way that anybody can track down that firm and shut them down. So it's a really interesting world. You can see stuff on my webpage, right? I'm not saying that's a plus. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that it's a different, interestingly different world, which is more attractive in some ways and less attractive than others. Right? That's why one of the things I do in the long version of this is to explain my business plan for Murder Incorporated. They're the people who sell the services of Hitman. Doesn't strike me as a good idea, but it's one of the things that could happen in this world. Good things and bad things. All right. One consequence, however, is that online contracts become unenforceable in the courts. To some extent, it's going to happen even without all of this, because the courts are geographical, in effect. They've got areas of jurisdiction. The internet, all international boundaries are transparent. And therefore, although it is legally possible after I bought something from an eBay seller in China, when it turns out it was a fake, legally speaking, I could go to law and try to prosecute him. As a practical matter, I know I can't. That enforcing law in China, unless it's for a very large amount of money, is just not worth the cost of trying to do it. In the full, strong privacy world, I can't do it because I don't know who he is. I also don't know if he's in China. He could be my next-door neighbor, for all I know. So that suggests that we might have a world that shifts to replacing court enforcement with reputational enforcement, which is what I'm really discussing in that China to Cyberspace article that you're all supposed to have read. And then we get the point I just made, that reputational enforcement requires ways in which interested third parties can figure out who's cheating. Arbitration does that. So my cyberspace version of the story is that you and I sign a contract. And signing it, we really sign it. I don't know where you are. I don't know who you are. I just know that you sell something I want to buy or some service or whatever. But the contract specifies our mutual obligations, and both of us digitally sign it, and both of us get a copy. And just to play safe, the contract also names the arbitrator who will settle any disputes about this contract. And the contract also includes the public key of that arbitrator. Now, one of us pulls out of the contract, the other one thinks he's cheating, case is submitted to the arbitrator gives a ruling. I either do or don't go along with the ruling. If I don't go along with the ruling, the arbitrator writes up his verdict, which is, I swindled you and I refuse to make it good. And he digitally signs it and hands you a copy. You now have a package of documents. The original contract, which I signed, and which you can prove I signed, because it's a digital signature, which includes the public key of the arbitrator, which is the information needed to check that that verdict is from the arbitrator I agreed to. So that means that you put that post, that package, up on a web page with my name all over it, my online identity reference. Anybody who's thinking of doing business with me, of course, does a Google search to see what he can learn about me. He finds the package, and the package isn't just an allegation. It's not as if it was just a page where you said I cheated you. It's got the evidence with which in a second and a half of computer time I can verify he can verify that I cheated you. So it's a very, very low-cost way of letting third parties figure out. And so my argument is this provides an interesting mechanism by which you can enforce law online without the courts. All right. So we're back with this question of how do you structure contracts to enforce, stuff I've already discussed a bit, but I'm discussing it in this context. In the article, it was partly because China, for a long time, didn't really have contract law, so you had to have other mechanisms to enforce. The hostage solution is one solution. But notice that reputational, one of the requirements for reputation to work is that you've got a reputation, that it'll cost you something to lose your reputation, that you could, after all, create an online identity today and then cheat me tomorrow, except that I'm not going to trust anybody who created his online identity yesterday. So if we're signing a contract, one of the things we might do is design the contract so that only one of us can cheat. If you imagine, go back to building a house. Suppose we couldn't use progress payments, and suppose there are no courts to enforce them. Now the question is, which of us will suffer serious reputational penalties if he breaks the contract? And if we imagine that you are a builder who builds 1,000 houses a year, and I am a private customer who buys one house in a lifetime, if you build and then expect to be paid, you're going to get a really unpleasant surprise, because it doesn't do me any harm to have builders not trust me. I'm never going to hire one again. On the other hand, assuming we've got a mechanism by which people can know who cheated, as in what I've described, if I pay in advance, I'm safe, because although you can cheat me, it isn't in your interest to do it because you'll blow your $1 million or $10 million reputation. So that suggests that one of the ways, going back to our real world of structuring contracts, is to say if we have to trust somebody, if there's no good way of setting up the contract where neither side can cheat at a profit, make it the person who will suffer the reputational costs if he actually does cheat. And I want to suggest that a lot of real contracts that look one-sided may be one-sided because they're one-sided in favor of the repeat player of Hertz or Avis and not of the one-time player, the customer. And that both parties really realize that the firm is great, not perfectly constrained, but substantially constrained by its reputation, and therefore the danger that I'll pay the money and they will give me a car which dies a quarter mile out of the lot and refuse to replace it is much lower than the danger if they had to trust me that I would go off with the car and they'd never see me again. All right. So I think a useful way of thinking about it is to think about it in terms of, put the liability on the person where it does most good, put the risk of cheating on the person who is least likely to cheat for other reasons. So that's, I think, a useful way of thinking about it. One other way of not needing a court is to rent a reputation. Suppose eBay does this, all right? I'm buying something valuable. I'm afraid it might not be as described. You're afraid that if you send it to me before I pay, I might not pay. So you send what supposedly is a lost Leonardo da Vinci painting to the escrow agency. I send my money to the escrow agency. I go inspect the painting. If I claim it's fake, my money goes back to me and the painting goes back to you. If I agree it's real, painting goes to me, money goes to you. So notice that if there aren't any courts involved, what's the great hole in the strategy, potentially? Who can cheat? You can't cheat. I can't cheat. Who can cheat? The escrow agency can cheat. They can keep the painting and keep my money. So, again, in a world without effective court enforcement, this depends on the escrow agency having a reputation which keeps them from cheating. So that's what I mean by renting a reputation here. Setting it up so that all of the cheating opportunities being given to somebody who you've selected because you're pretty sure he won't cheat. All right. Anyway, that finishes this. So we get to talk about all this juicy family law stuff next week and think about the marriage contract. I like to claim that I would have been married several years earlier if it hadn't taken me so long to convince the woman in question of the virtue of long-term contracts. And the fact that she puts up with my saying it is one of the pieces of evidence that I married the right person.
You got a pretty good deal.
Uh-huh. I did.